We'd like to welcome everyone to the work session for the City Council meeting of January 17th. And our honored guests are Senators Todd Wyler, Senator Wyler and Representative Melissa Ballard, our two elected officials from this area. So welcome. We're bribing you with gifts and food. So we expect lots of results now, I guess. do you want to start off with just a little 8 bars of what you're hoping to do this year, and then we'll attack you with questions.
First, thank you for having us. It's really nice to be among neighbors and friends. This is home for sure. I think in general for the legislature, you'll see tax cuts. The conversation that I've asked constantly is, I love tax cuts as long as we're paying our state employees what we need to pay them. For me, that's really important to put them up on parity. And so I always bring that up, because once you cut the tax, you can't get it back. And so doing the math, I think we have a lot of state employees who we're having a hard time retaining. So you'll see that. There's a lot of emphasis on teacher retention. I actually have 2 bills to help that. One of them is postpartum leave, and actually requiring that schools allow vacation sharing and sick leave among staff and teachers to help with some of those days that might be needed. Right now, most districts don't allow administration to even share sick days or vacation days. And I think there's a lot of incentive within an actual school to share those days to help each other. So I think that'll reduce the cost and help teachers to be for retention. Right now, some school districts actually require that teachers pay substitutes while they're out on postpartum leave. You will see a lot for water, which affects us directly. There's a lot being done, billions of dollars in efforts. You'll see a lot for housing. For me personally, I appreciate North Salt Lake and the work that you did in the easement down at the airport for future growth for those homes and businesses that are the flyover space for future airport space. I've actually been working with airports across the state for that to be policy around the state. So your work with that is good practice. That is a legislation for me. I focused a lot on recidivism and reducing recidivism. We're defining that this year. And I've done a lot for education in the prisons and changing the culture in prisons. So our corrections are amenable, but it makes a difference to have things in code. So it's not free rides by any means, but it's actually on parity with inmates being able to apply for scholarships, Pell Grants, just like we do when for the common citizen. So it's equal access, really. And my legislation this year requires tablets for the inmates, for their records, for their communication. There's companies that provide free tablets and so forth. So I think it's going to see a lot of education access, programming access, reduce costs, and ultimately really be encouraging for those inmates to have a future that they can actually have hope for the first time. Many of us know someone who's been in prison, and I have a relative who's been in and out for 35 years. So you talk about the problems of recidivism. I appreciate my mother's patience, but her experience that has really led to last year's bill and this year's bill. So worked a lot with CCJJ and others on really making those changes. So I'm really proud of that work, and we'll continue along those lines. So That's a little summary. I do have a handful of education bills. They took me off of the education committee, and I'm on an economic and workforce development, but that means I won't be in that committee because I'll always be waiting for my turn in education. So I'm also on law enforcement and the chair of higher ed appropriations. So just in summary with that, as the chair, I've really changed the accountability process for higher ed of what they're reporting to and how they are aligning with workforce development in their programming. So I've really done a lot, even as vice chair last year and what we're doing this year. There's a lot that's changing in articulation across different institutions and facilitating for our students to be able to have simpler application process, simpler scholarship process, and being able to transfer easily. English 1010 is English 1010 regardless of which institution you're in. So we're doing a lot of good things in higher ed and driving that on our legislative committee.
Thank you. Senator Weiler?
Thank you. Try not to blow you away. I appreciate you having us here. I appreciate all the service that you do on the city council. I know a little bit about serving on city council. I know it's a tough job. And so thank you for your service to your community. As I look at the names on the council, I mean, Lisa, council member Baskin, of course, used to work for the legislature and has a lot of political experience. I don't know that there's any couple in the state that has more experience collectively than Ron and Natalie Gordon with their backgrounds and their experience. So I think that you all have a, and then all of you I know have tracked the legislature for years. And so you have probably more insight than I think most city councils do into the process. This year I'll continue to chair the Judicial Confirmation Committee. So I work with all of the judges that I used to work with Ron Gordon on that before he changed jobs. But one unique thing this session, I think this will be the first time this has happened, at least that I can think of, we're going to confirm three new state court judges during the legislative session, including a new member of the Utah Court of Appeals that the governor just nominated last week, Amy Oliver. I'll also continue to chair the Judiciary's Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Standing Committee in the Senate. And I don't know how many of you track legislative committees, but in the House, they have a Judiciary Standing Committee, and then they have a Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Standing Committee. In the Senate, we combine those into one committee. So I effectively chair two House committees, so all of those bills come to my committee. In fact, today, the first day of the session, we were assigned 17 bills for our first agenda, and I don't think we'll get through all of those. But and because of my background as a lawyer and because of my committee position, I end up handling most of the legal issues, not all of them, but on the Senate side, which is an honor and privilege, but also keeps me busy. So I'll tell you, I make this joke every year, but you'll be disappointed if I don't. I have just over 20 bills, so I'll just spend 2 minutes on each of them. Just kidding. Everybody's doing the math. But I'll tell you quickly about two of my bills that have gotten some media attention. One of them it deals with intimate partner domestic violence. And for 6 years on the Senate floor, I sat next to then Senator Deidre Henderson. She's, of course, now our lieutenant governor. And unfortunately, her cousin, who was a little bit disabled, was murdered last August by her cousin's ex-husband. And as Deidre and I have looked at that case, there were many, many opportunities where law enforcement and others could have seen some red flags, but they didn't. And in fact, in many ways, it's somewhat similar to the case of the University of Utah student that was murdered about 5 years ago. And in any event, so we've been looking at that, and her family was just devastated by Mandy's loss. And so we've been looking at closing the gaps in that. So I've been literally crisscrossing the state with Lieutenant Governor for about 5 months. We've met with law enforcement, including your own police chief. We've met with prosecutors, defense attorneys, lawyers, judges, trying to see what we could do. And we've kind of settled on two points in that bill. The first one is we will require all law enforcement, when they come into contact with a potential intimate partner domestic violence, to ask 11 questions of the victim. And that could be a male or a female victim. And those 11 questions constitute something that's called the lethality assessment protocol. You may not be surprised that your police department in North Salt Lake is already doing that. And so this really, that part of my bill will have no effect on the North Salt Lake Police Department or any police department in Davis County, which is great. But about half of the police agencies in Utah are not asking those questions. And so we're going to mandate that. And based on the responses to those questions, we hope the police officer will, in relevant circumstances, immediately put the victim in touch with social services, women's shelter, et cetera, advise them that, you know, they're in danger and they shouldn't go home that night, again, depending on their responses. But we believe that that would have saved Mandy's life. And ironically, as this bill has gotten some media attention over the past couple of weeks, a representative from Gabby Petito's family in Florida reached out to me last week, and they want to come to Utah and testify in favor of this bill. They believe that would have saved Gabby's life, and I'm sure all of you mourned her loss like we did. The second thing that that bill does is it'll create a database. So if one of Chief Black's officers were to pull me over on the way home from here, and please don't send them out, Chief. But by typing in my license plate, they would access a database. They would immediately know if I had a warrant out for my arrest. I don't right now. They might even see, can they see my driver's history? No, but they could see a warrant and things like that. But if I were to forge a prescription and go to Walgreens on the way home, the pharmacist at Walgreens could access a database and see how many other opioid prescriptions I've been prescribed and how many other times I've tried to pass off that same prescription this week. So we have databases in place in Utah in appropriate circumstances, but we don't have a database that tracks how many interactions someone has had with intimate partner domestic violence. The reason I keep on saying intimate partner is about over 80% of our domestic violence calls in the state are one-off situations. It might be a mother fighting with their son, et cetera. But the intimate partner ones, this is usually someone that you've been involved intimately with. Those are the ones that we're targeting. And so this database would just track those law enforcement encounters. And so in the situation with Lieutenant Governor's cousin, she had interacted with police twice before, you know, in the days leading up to her murder, but each time it was in a different city, and the law enforcement kind of gave him, the perpetrator, the benefit of the doubt. They thought it was a first-time thing, and I think Chief Black would agree with me. If an officer responds and they think this is a one-off incident, they're probably going to treat it differently if they know this is the third time in 3 days that law enforcement's been involved, and so that's what that database would help those officers ascertain. The other bill I'm running is a follow-up on some work I've been doing for years based on constituent requests, and that would be we're going to copycat what Louisiana did last month, and we're going to require some age verification when people from Utah log on to an adult pornographic website and require them to show that they're an adult. It's illegal in all 50 states for minors to access hardcore pornography. And yet, you know, if you go online and try to buy vaping products or tobacco products, or if you're not in Utah, direct wine shipments, those companies all have to age verify. They can't ship a carton of, you know, Marlboro cigarettes to a 14-year-old. If they did, they would be in trouble. And yet, you know, with pornographic websites, we're not doing that. And so about 7 years ago, I passed the bill that declared pornography to be a public health crisis in Utah. And I did that at great expense. I was made fun of on the Tonight Show and Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon. They had a lot of fun with me. But it's interesting because like 16 other states have now followed Utah's lead in that, and that it is harmful for our children. And I think even though age verification is not something that a savvy teenager wouldn't be able to circumvent, we know that kids as young as 7, 8, and 9 are being exposed to this harmful material. And so it'll be, you know, another effort to protect kids from porn. So those are two of the things that I'm working on. I'd be happy to answer your questions or listen to your feedback.
Thank you. I I have a few items that I thought I'd start with, and then we'll turn it over to the council. We have reached out in the past about a hope to modify the wrap tax. Do you have an update on that at all?
Yeah, I need to follow up with the Senate president. I talked to him about it at length, and he didn't seem vehemently opposed to it. And I know we were talking about some other cities that would get on board with that. So, I'm if you're still interested in just, and I don't know if Representative Ballard or everybody listening knows, but this would give cities an option to put it to a vote to the people if they wanted to have a citywide wrap tax. And so, when I was first approached on this a few months ago, I said, let me talk to the Senate president, see of how he feels about it. But he, quite frankly, he was, this is Stuart Adams we're talking about, he was somewhat neutral. So he wasn't, you know, against it, which was a good thing. So I don't run a lot of tax legislation. I'm not on that, the tax and the revenue tax committee. But if you're interested in that, I'll give it a try. I'll have to, that kind of escaped my attention recently. So I'll have to open up a new bill file, which means it'll probably come out at the end of the session. But sometimes that's better because it gets a little bit less scrutiny, to be honest with you.
I'll just add. So if I you asked me to send you some other communities. Who might?
And you sent me some. Can you remind me?
I sent you some information on that. I could do that again if.
If you wouldn't mind, just resend that to me, Ken.
And then or council member. Other thing I was going to mention is. I also kind of brought it up with the Utah City Management Association and the League of Cities and Towns, and there's a lot of support for the concept.
Good.
So I think you'd find support among those groups.
I expect you're going to see some opposition from, and I'm saying this based on my previous experience, you'll see some opposition from, I think, really conservative Republicans, because even though the bill would not constitute a tax increase, I've seen other legislation which would just allow the people to vote whether or not they want that, and I've seen kind of the far right come out against that.
And truthfully, it's important, so you know, if that type of a bill were to not pass, it's not the end of the world for North Salt Lake or anybody else, because our wrap tax has been reauthorized twice. I expect that it would be
sure.
It would continue to be reauthorized. The citizens like parks, everyone else, all the other communities around us impose the tax, and so it doesn't make sense that we wouldn't. And I think the citizenry kind of understands that. So it's not, this isn't solving a problem as important as your bill on domestic violence or anything like that. So,
sure. Well,
you know, if it doesn't get off the ground, you know, we'd love to have it get off the ground, but if it doesn't, I just want everyone to know
it's nice to have something that goes.
Yeah.
It's a good tool.
If you bond for 15 years and your wrap tax drops off in four.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit of a challenge for communities. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. I guess I want to just put in my 2 cents for lowering tax rates.
We're going to do that. I mean, and income tax rates this year, for sure.
As a homeowner, I like the idea of that 45%. Ceiling become the floor. As a building manager, I recognize that ox is going to get gored but buildings don't vote. So, but we also don't send kids to school. You know, no one in my buildings uses a public school, and so they're paying the lion's share. So that's a tough one. Whichever hat I put on there.
I'll make a comment if I could here about the taxes. In the last 5 years, we have reduced $320 million taxes for every year, right? So that's how much we've already done. We've also reduced sales, those who pay Social Security tax. I think it's now if you earn more than $70,000 or $75,000 a year, or if you earn less than that, you don't pay any tax on your Social Security, and then it tiers upwards the higher that it goes.
You don't pay any tax the second time because you still pay tax on it the first time.
Yeah. So we'll probably address that again. But I think there's we're definitely looking at a handful of places for adjustment for the taxes.
I had Social Security here. I think we're one of only 9 states. 15 states that we pay taxes on.
I ran a bill in 2016 to completely remove that double taxation off Social Security. It had a $60 million fiscal note, which means Utah was making $60 million a year by double taxing Social Security. So my bill failed because I couldn't fund that fiscal note. So.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with my age, but I bring that up.
Me neither.
I did have, I'm going to see how sharp you are here. House Bill 131 and SB 60. Oh, you guys don't have that memorized?
Not yet.
There was a concern on a board I sit with that this is sex offenders and HOAs, not allowing sex offenders. So the question came up, are the HOAs potentially liable? How do they enforce this? How do they know? So there was a lot of questions. I mean, we can all sit here and say, yeah, we don't want sex offenders hanging out at the pools that are HOAs. But there was.
I haven't seen those bills come up for a vote in the Senate yet. I will tell you, I've been working now for about 3 years on the sex offender registry. And I think it's really easy to thump your chest and say, yeah, these people need to, you know, lock them up and throw away the key. But back in the 80s, when we created the sex offender registry, we threw a bunch of people on there. Quite frankly, some of them belonged on there and some of them didn't. And we put a bunch of people on there for life. And so I've been tweaking with that registry and that database for the last 3 years. And we've seen more and more people deservedly come off that, which means they can get housing, they can get jobs. Their relatives aren't embarrassed when they come over to visit. But again, some people absolutely belong in there. But with these types of bills, and I haven't read the bill you're referencing, we have to be careful because we can easily create communities where a sex offender can't live, can't work, you know, can't catch a bus. And so I'll look at that bill with some scrutiny because we all want to protect our kids, right? Of course, but sometimes we go overboard on some of these provisions.
And I'll mention to you, Senator Wyler, in one of our House committees, we talked about the registry. And I think what's crucial to that does not need to be a bill, but it could be added to a bill or just in statute, that those sex offenders, when they have to re-register every year and report where they're living every 6 months and those kinds of things, they, out of fairness, they should be told, here's where you are in how long you need to be here, here's the new laws that would apply to you. They don't have any notification when laws change or when their status changes. They just think that they're forever on those lists. So I think out of fairness for what we do in the legislature, they should know when those changes apply to them.
I've gotten calls from I get a lot of calls from moms of sex offenders. And, you know, typical story, you know, my son was a freshman in college 15 years ago. He went to a frat party, had sex with a girl who said she was a college freshman. She was a high school sophomore. He's on the sex offender database. Now he's 34. He can't take his kids to the park because he's, you know, on the registry. Again, I am not anybody who is a danger to our children. We need to be very careful about. But there are we have caught up a lot of people and labeled them as sex offenders. But I don't know that it was justified.
Yeah, I agree. Only final comments. I get nervous when there's extra money and you start throwing it.
But how much do you need, Mayor?
Yeah. The Great Salt Lake's a concern, obviously, for us, but we need to get more water flowing into it and not feeding the Phragmites. So I don't know. When they say they're going to throw money at the Great Salt Lake, I hope that's kind of where they're headed.
It was in the area of $500 million last year, and I think we're ready to do that again. I will tell you, if you haven't heard, the Great Salt Lake has raised over a foot in the last 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So Mother Nature is certainly helping, but I don't know that there's a higher priority of the legislature than saving the Great Salt Lake right now. But you know, when we have a report that comes out that says it'll all be dried up and gone in 5 years, then we just get 1,000 emails. But I don't think there's a higher priority right now than that. And so we're going to do whatever it takes to save the Great Salt Lake.
Okay. The other one is affordable housing, and I don't have any answers, but maybe tax credits are a better way to go than money.
Good news is housing prices have been dropping, ironically, as interest rates have gone up. But yeah, I don't have the answer to that either. And I don't think that that's a problem that the state government can or should fix. I'm not saying we can't do some proper incentivizing, but you know, it's more of a economical market problem, I think it is, than a state law problem. That's my personal opinion.
Okay.
This morning, the speaker in his opening remarks mentioned that there are some cities that are doing this really, really well, and he has three mayors there in particular that he wanted to highlight. But there's also some that are not doing it so well. Some that are not far from here, some that that may need a little bit more perspective of how to do better at looking at their planning. And so I don't know if that was hinting that there was going to be legislation from the speaker or that was going to be put forward. I don't know what that meant, but that's my guess, is they're going to do some. But I do want to say, I think it was about 3 years ago, we passed legislation for you as municipalities to prepare what your plan is and submit it. But it wasn't until this last year that there was actually a follow-up, because not everybody had even submitted a plan. So I think that that's going to be an important part, because I think the one important role of the state is to facilitate. And if they don't know who needs help, they can't do anything about it. So I don't know if that's part of what they're doing. Well, you know, we often don't know what other legislators and committees are working on, but that's the hint that I got this morning from the speaker.
Thank you. Lisa?
I have just one comment on affordable housing, if you don't mind. In my work with the league, and I'm pretty involved in this issue of affordable housing, I think the state has done a really great job in the last 4 or 5 years putting sequential bills together, bringing cities and counties along, and I think the progress the state has made is really phenomenal. The one thing that remains a little frustrating is that there may be, in fact, some bad actor cities out there. We're not one of them. And I would suggest that as you work with your colleagues, there are some narratives that sort of put all cities into one basket, as if we're all offenders when we charge building permitting fees, or we take a little too long on a building permit that might be a complicated permit. And that's just not the case. So I think the majority of Wasatch Front cities in particular are as committed as the state is to resolving affordable housing, to accepting ADUs, to providing zoning that allows for high density housing. I've been impressed that a lot of cities who I never thought would come along have now supposedly, you know, they've drunk the Kool-Aid, if you want to say it that way.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have a number, the developers in our state are not underrepresented in the
yes.
legislature. That doesn't include Representative Ballard or myself. But I just want to say, I don't know that we're good at forcing that issue. And I represent Centerville City, and they build all that housing out by the movie theater, and those units are now renting for like $1,900 for a two-bedroom.
Yeah.
And they're like, affordable housing, like that's more expensive than renting an older house in the city. And so I don't know that we're always good at getting the outcomes that we try to, but I'm sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted you.
No, I think affordable housing is one issue. The housing shortage in general is the other issue. And it is alarming that rents in North Salt Lake have done that, and it's really frustrating. I have children who can't buy a house right now, and the rents are crazy. But I guess I just wanted to say, as you hear from your peers, please let them know that most cities are behaving properly, we're not overcharging, we're not being unreasonable with developers. And I think that message gets lost a little bit.
I think that's true, and I echo that. I will say, 4 years ago, we were being told at the legislature that there were about 60,000 family units in Utah that couldn't find housing. Now we're being told it's about half of that. So we seem to be moving in the right direction.
That's right. Thank you.
Thanks for what you're doing. First day of the session. I can't wait to see you in 45 days.
It's not going to be pretty.
It's exciting. It's the best time of year, I think. But anyway, couple of things I wanted to mention. One is House Bill 73. I'm talking about bills that impact cities, most importantly. It's municipal office modifications by Welton, and it's saying if the city doesn't appoint someone in time, the governor gets to appoint. Please don't let that happen, all right? We'll get the appointment done in time, but it is a local function, not something for the governor to do, to appoint city council members or mayors. Okay, so that's House Bill 73. House Bill, what's the other one that I thought? The Noise Pollution Amendments, House Bill 95. Pay close attention to that one. Because it impacts cities that are, for example, I represent Moab City at City Council, and they're trying to deal with noise pollution with all of those ATVs, and it's gotten kind of very politicized, and that may be a solution to some of these problems if we can do this decibel measurements properly and that sort of. So pay attention to that one. That's Bennion. And then there's another one, Senate Bill 63, the Brambles doing. Election Candidate Replacement Amendments. And in that, he says that the state central committee can appoint to city councils, which are nonpartisan elected offices.
And who's the sponsor on that one?
Bramble.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. And then there's a lot. House Bill 196 has eminent domain revisions that I'm going to pay close attention to. The one I'm worried about, too, is the public notice requirements. Senator Pitcher, Senate Bill 43, is going to create a new grid of whatever kind of meeting you're having, if it's an A or a B or C, and reclassify and a subclassification so that you know you need 7 days for this, you need 15 days for this, and so forth. I'm not sure if it's going to be helpful. It may be so arcane and so complicated that it may not help us at all with regard to public notice.
And let me just interrupt you for a second. For those of you that don't know, Senator Pitcher was Representative Pitcher last year, but now Senator Pitcher. She actually works for Troy Rawlings here in Davis County as a prosecutor. She represents, you know, parts of Salt Lake County, but she's in Davis County 40 hours a week. So just, I don't know if you knew that, but I'll talk to her about that bill because she, my experience working with her, she usually has a good reason for doing things, so I'll check with her on that.
Yeah, I'd want it to make it so that it's less complicated. And I don't quite understand what we're doing with the state constitutional amendment, SJR1. We're going to have the ceiling at 45%, but there's some language in here that says cities cannot tax the transfer property. And I don't quite understand that. So I'm going to call you, and maybe we can talk through that.
Okay, and I haven't dug into that one, but is that dealing with a transfer tax?
Or? I think so, but it's a revenue tax constitutional amendment, but it's got the ceiling. You can't tax anything above 45%, right?
So many of you probably know this. A lot of states, not Utah, when you sell your home or business, when you sell real property, you pay a state transfer tax. And so I'm not sure
This is for cities.
Okay, interesting. I'll have to look at that one, SJR1.
Yeah, SJR1.
Who's the sponsor on that?
McKay,
okay.
All right, thanks so much for
what you're doing. Thank you, Councilwoman, Councilmember Baskin.
Anyone else have any questions or comments? Natalie, you weren't here, but they were already raving about you and Ron. So.
Oh, that's
it was me. I was
very kind.
Raving,
thank you. So. You're kind of on our family.
Did he say raving? I was waving.
Waving.
No, I'm just kidding.
Both. Drive by. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your service. And I apologize for being late. It was something I could not control today. But thank you for being so responsive to our city. This is just such a rewarding and gracious thing that you're doing, meeting with us tonight. and also taking our calls during the session. So thanks.
Your number's blocked, but yes. Anybody else?
Yeah. I didn't just unfollow you on Twitter. Yeah. I deleted my whole account.
Okay, there you go.
I just text them both. They always text me right back.
And I would comment to all of you, we appreciate your input. And we have a lot of bills that we're working in the House before they even go to the Senate and vice versa. So when you text us personally and say, whether it is as a council, this is how we feel, or how I personally feel, or how it would affect our city, it does make a difference, because then we can speak to it with detail as to why it would be beneficial or not. So we do look for you. You are also elected representatives of our neighbors, right? And understand the ins and outs of our cities. I have a website, melissagarfballard.com, that you can see newsletters. If you're not, or anybody in our city is not subscribed to my newsletters, you just go there and put your email in, because I give frequent updates and give links for bills or information that I'm not an expert at everything, but I do get a lot of information, and I try to share that so that you are empowered and you can choose what you're interested in or what you're concerned about. And so I think that's helpful for all of our neighbors to just get updates on my newsletter.
And my website is melissagarfballard.net.
Yeah,
so no, don't get those mixed up.
You have to check your age before you can log in.
That's right.
The other thing I wanted to mention on the Legislative Policy Committee, Ken is on it for our city, the mayor's on it, and I'm on it. So we'll be the ones that can vote.
And I was on it 20 years ago,
yeah.
Just so you know.
I have two things I'd like to bring up. Also, first, echoing these sentiments, thanks for being here and thanks for being so responsive. I've spoken to both of you, and I really appreciate that access. The two things that I want to talk about are more conceptual. They're not tied to any particular bill. The first of those is education, and I know that you know this because you hear a lot of information that I'm not even privy to, but our state really is underfunded in education, and we are barreling towards an education crisis. I know that a lot of the concept in how we handle education is a free market economy, and that as long as when we get to the point where teachers will no longer teach for the amount of money that we pay them, then the market will correct itself, because we won't be able to have teachers, and then we'll have to start paying them more. And we are there. We are there right now in Davis County, at Davis School District. We cannot hire enough teachers. We cannot hire enough aides. We cannot hire enough bus drivers. We cannot hire enough lunchroom workers. We cannot hire enough staff, because what we're paying them is insufficient. So while many people value tax breaks, I do as well. I appreciate that. I don't appreciate that at the cost of funding education in a much better, more comprehensive way, and in a way that really responds to what the market is telling us, which is that our education system is not going to sustain itself without making adjustments that respond to what the market is telling us. My children are at Foxborough Elementary, and they're in the dual language immersion program, which means they bring in French teachers that were educated in Europe. And there is a marked difference in the teachers that come here from Europe, in a culture where teachers are valued and paid well, and their skill level, and that the way they run their classroom looks very different. Currently, teachers don't even have to have a degree in teaching, a degree in education, to be teachers. Nevertheless, have achieved any degree. They have an alternate route to licensure. Now, I see those as very innovative and creative ways that it's solving a problem while we're trying to figure out exactly what the market is saying. But I think the market is saying right now, teachers are not going to handle this any longer, and we need to do something about it. So as a concept, consider in those conversations, how do we better fund education? Maintaining funding is insufficient. Increasing funding is the only way for us to really respond to the crisis that education is in the state. To education, the dual language immersion program, and I know that that's really something that's run through the State Board of Education, currently in Foxborough and in Woods Cross, which are constituents that both of you cover, there are two French immersion programs, and because of restrictions within the district, they are no longer going to be able to have immersion programs at both of those schools, and it's really created a situation where these two communities next door to each other are pitted against each other to fight over who gets to keep the program. And we're kind of, it feels like we're fighting over the scraps. We only have a certain amount of money we can use to run this program, so fight over who gets to have it, instead of looking, you know, among our scrap, looking up and saying, hey, how about you just fund us better so we can both still have these programs, so that we're not just trying to scrap through, you know, the low resources that we have. So that's the first concept. The second concept is much more specific, and it represents Foxborough, which is, again, constituents that you both represent. anyone who's been any privy to any news about Foxborough in the last year, it does not look good. And Foxborough continues as a community, but particularly as the elementary school, continues to be disparaged in the news, and it's in a really misinformed way. I'm referring directly to the tragedy that was sustained at the school last year. Public information about that particular experience is misinformed. And I met recently with the school district and the school board to request that they share information with key decision makers that provides better information. I don't want to be any part of disparaging the family that is grieving to correct that information, but I would like to publicly and directly request and ask you to do the same for individuals who are in the fight for anti-bullying and anti-racism, as I am, to stop using that story as an example, because it is a misinformed example. And when people find information and details about that example, it really undercuts the entire movement of anti-bullying, because that's not really the story of what was happening in that situation. I've asked specifically for the district to request the Jazz to stop using that as an example. And there are legislators that use that story as an example. And I encourage you to share the information and request that those legislators maybe contact the Davis School District and ask for the independent report that was created, so they can be informed on what exactly was going on in that situation, because it's not the story that is in the news. And there's no counter stories being shared about Foxborough. Foxborough as a community is still really suffering. Foxborough as an elementary school is still really suffering. And the class of sixth graders who were classmates last year are individually and suffering. Because in a confusing way, they were told that they bullied a little girl to death, and they can't see that that happened. And so there's no real ability to get better or to have any type of self-awareness to trust their instincts, trust their relationships, trust how they act in the world. So that is just kind of any time you are hearing that story, if you could yourselves, and then also encourage others to become better informed in whatever way is possible. I've requested that the school district share that information wherever they can. I know that there's pending legislation and there are some restrictions because of that, but I think in the fear of sharing information based on pending legislation.
You mean litigation?
No. So, excuse me, yes, litigation, thank you. No information is being shared, and that is not necessary. Let's share as much as we can so that misinformation doesn't continue to be shared, because there's a cost, and I'm in the neighborhood that is bearing that cost. So, thank you.
I think that's good feedback, and you know, I'm aware, and I can tell you the entire Senate, I can't speak for the House, is aware. I mean, Izzy didn't live in Davis County. Her family was bringing her up to that school because that school had reached out and embraced her, and I think her sister. And so, just so you know, we're not as maybe isolated and naive as you might think. But you're not wrong. Everything you said is correct, and obviously, there's, you know, a $50 or $60 million lawsuit going on, so I don't have any personal knowledge. I have read the report. I know it was widely distributed among senators when it came out, so thank you.
And I appreciate that. Thank you.
I appreciate your helping us to help spread that message. In response to education and their teacher pay, two things about that. One of them is we've increased the WPU substantially over the last number of years, even 6%. And right now, superintendents are in charge of determining pay for staff, for teachers, for all of that. They determine that. This year, so if you want to put more pressure, we keep giving them more money. You put pressure on your local school boards. But this year, the good news is there is a proposal for the largest single increase in teacher salary of $6,000 per teacher that's ever been done in the history of Utah, specifically to the teachers, not a roundabout way. The bad news is they've tied it to a voucher bill, which means they should be two different bills. Do we want to raise the teacher salary? Do we want a voucher bill? Voucher bills have come up every year for the last 3 years, you know, every 3 years or something they tend to come up, but they've put it into one bill. So that's the bad news in my mind, is that those are two totally separate decisions that should be made. But we are very cognizant. I've been on the education committee for many years, and there's a lot of work for accountability and for improving that. In fact, Utah voters changed the Constitution a couple of years ago to allow for income tax to go also for children and those with disabilities, which what allowed, instead of just education, what allowed us to do as legislators is actually to guarantee funding for education, guarantee growth every year increases, guarantee the food program and so forth, that before it's just because income tax was doing well doesn't mean we should spend all of that because the next year it would fluctuate. We had to guarantee something consistent when we give raises. And so I appreciate Utah taxpayers and voters choosing that, because that has helped the legislature to be more constant in funding. And so I think we more and more, for the reason you said, will be putting more emphasis on specific salary increases. But it's still, even though it's a $6,000 increase, it is still up to superintendents to and local school boards to make that decision of additional monies we continue to give them if they're going to pay their teachers more. And it's not a set rate across the state because cost of living is different and it creates a little competition between districts. But that's a little bit of reality check and opportunity.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And then I would just like to extend an invitation to either of you as representatives that where your constituents are in Foxborough. If you have any interest in visiting the elementary school, I would love to facilitate that. Have any press conferences that you want, share any information. We would welcome you, and we would welcome the positive press as well.
And any schools that come to the Capitol, let us know.
Yeah,
I
for sure.
always love to come out and host them for a few minutes and welcome them. And so if any of your school children come to the Capitol, yes, and we'd love to come to your schools.
And I just say, I can remember recently visiting Odyssey and Spectrum. I'm not sure that I visited Foxborough. I visited a lot of other elementary schools in Bountiful, but I do my best because I'm juggling this with my other job. So, but thank you. Thank you.
All right. Anything else?
Well, I should at least say thank
oh.
you. I don't need to
Sorry,
speak
Sam.
Up and tell you all the worries I have for the state. And I don't have that many worries. I know that we had quite the lesson given us on this water problem and getting water to the Great Salt Lake, and it's a very complicated problem. I realize that now, that with all the water rights that people think they own and have owned for 100 years, and trying to negotiate that away from them is going to be very difficult. So,
can I just tell you, we did a change last year that didn't get a lot of publicity, but over the next two generations, it's going to do more for the Great Salt Lake and all the other lakes than anything else will do. It's not going to refill the Great Salt Lake this month, but in Utah, going back 100 years, we in water law, we had a use it or lose it law. And so if you didn't exercise your water rights for like 7 years in a row, they reverted back to the state. So we eliminated that last year. And what we were doing with that law before we changed it was we were incentivizing farmers and others who didn't need the water to use it anyway, so that they didn't lose those rights. By that one simple change, it'll be a generational shift. Again, it's not something that you're going to see this year, but over the next 50 years and next 100 years, that's probably the biggest change we could have made. And I'm not saying we're done, we'll continue to do more. But the other thing I want to say is, farmers have been now are under attack, and especially those who grow alfalfa hay. You can tell a farmer in Milford, Utah, that they can't grow alfalfa anymore. That doesn't put one drop of water back into the Great Salt Lake. So we're going to be a little bit more strategic than that. And there's a lot of proposals on the table. But I'll end with what I said 5 minutes ago. There's not a bigger priority right now than saving the Great Salt Lake. So we'll do whatever has to be done to make sure that happens.
And I would have a request of you. I know that when I knock on a lot of doors, especially this last year, the number one concern was water because our residents were trying to conserve water and some were very stressed about their plants and trees. So whatever the policy is, if it is a, your choice, this is what we recommend, or this is a mandate, to just make sure that the North Salt Lake citizens understand that, because some of them, anyway, I think that education is crucial. I know that we saved a lot of water by residents conserving water, but I have actually put more more request for the state of Utah to actually look at larger users, not just the farmers, but really more industrial users and others, because they really consume so much more water in larger volumes. And if they can do better efficiencies, that's going to save a lot more than you and I trying to not water our tree in the backyard. So I think it's all the above. I also know that there's a veterans group that's working on clearing some of the trees and fallen trees and so forth in our forestries that actually will improve water coming down our way. So there's a lot of things going on, but in the meantime, I want to thank all the residents in each other and our neighbors for trying to do something a little different. I saw a lot of dry grass and plants, but I think that balance of making sure our plants and trees don't die and our grass is going to survive, you know, is something that everybody's really concerned about. So that information, I know they appreciate from you.
On a positive note, today I saw my first tweet that asking the governor to ask the local LDS congregations to stop praying for moisture. So we've hit.
I was with the governor last week, and he said that when they were finalizing the budget last November, December, he suggested that they put in $5 million in this, you know, next year's state budget that starts on July 1st for flood mitigation. And his staff all laughed at him. He said, "No, I'm serious." And of course, as you all know, there now we have flooding and Draper and other areas. And this may warm some of your hearts, but Greg Hughes, the former speaker, has been bailing out his basement for a week now with sump pumps. Anyway, that got a bigger laugh than it should have. But anyway.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. Thanks for the delicious dinner. So
yes, thank you for having us. We appreciate all that you do.
We especially appreciate when you feed us. So thank you.
Let's take a 5-minute break. We're running a little behind, so we'll be back at 10 after. Thanks.
And then you responded immediately to my request about this fourth person, because I have no clue. He must represent more than half.
Sneaking up behind you with a nice gigantic
film. Yeah, I kind of looked through the pages. There's a lot there.
Welcome to the best run city in Utah.
You know, I was going to use those same words in my presentation.
Yeah, it's almost a waste of money to have an audit. What are we doing?
Thank you.
noticed in the newsletter that says that if you replace your roof, you're hot water heater again.
Caitlin had said that she was talking about. So as she started, like, she had just raised up. She was able to, even though she was a step aside.
I didn't know I'm a hot water heater either. I've been raising the
They mentioned to me last week.
Yeah, so that's what that
is. Okay.
So between the three of us, we're going to have we were going to put a
we have a lot of stuff. So bad. This is so funny.